Cambridge Certificate of Proficiency in English 5 by University of Cambridge ESOL Examinations in conjunction with Cambridge University Press. This recording is copyright. CD 1 Cambridge Certificate of Proficiency in English Listening Test. Test 1
I'm going to give you the instructions for this test. I'll introduce each part of the test and give you time to look at the questions. At the start of each piece, you'll hear this sound. You'll hear each piece twice. Remember, while you're listening, write your answers on the question paper. You'll have 5 minutes at the end of the test to copy your answers onto the separate answer sheet. There'll now be a pause. Please ask any questions now because you must not speak during the test. Now open your question paper and look at part one. You'll hear 4 different extracts. For questions 1 to 8, choose the answer A, B or C, which fits best according to what you hear. There are 2 questions for each extract. Extract 1.
The first science fiction film was Rocket to the Moon, made in 1902. According to one movie director not known for his succinct use of language, the appeal of science fiction is that it's the modern equivalent of ancient myths where the fantasy world that's created provides the backdrop against which human nature can come up trumps in the face of adversity. And ever since that first movie, we've been vicariously hurling our bodies into the void, to the moon, and above all to Mars. For several decades, Mars was a place of awe, even in, say, the 1938 film Flash Gordon's Trip to Mars, in which all the Martians spoke English. Seems laughably naive now. In the 1950s, science fiction gained a tinge of science fact, not to mention politics. A decade later, the increasingly sophisticated movie-going audience was drifting away to other genres, after more convincing special effects, or out of the cinema altogether. And for a few years there was little filmmakers could do to stem the flow. The first science fiction film was Rocket to the Moon, made in 1902. According to one movie director not known for his succinct use of language, the appeal of science fiction is that it's the modern equivalent of ancient myths where the fantasy world that's created provides the backdrop against which human nature can come up trumps in the face of adversity. And ever since that first movie, we've been vicariously hurling our bodies into the void, to the moon, and above all to Mars. For several decades, Mars was a place of awe, even in, say, the 1938 film Flash Gordon's Trip to Mars, in which all the Martians spoke English. Seems laughably naive now. In the 1950s, science fiction gained a tinge of science fact, not to mention politics. A decade later, the increasingly sophisticated movie-going audience was drifting away to other genres, after more convincing special effects, or out of the cinema altogether. And for a few years, there was little filmmakers could do to stem the flow.
Extract 2.
Now, Dr. Peters, in your new book, you talk about a superorganism, and you give the example of an ant colony. But I haven't been able to find an entry for superorganism in my dictionary of science.
Well, you see, many scientists have been skeptical about the usefulness of explaining large structures in nature that seem in some way to behave like an organism when they are not actually alive in any sense that we normally use the term. Appealing simple ideas aren't always precise and can cause confusion.
So, what you're saying is that the superorganism idea of a group of organisms acting together like a larger organism has no precise definition.
Indeed. However, social insects such as ants, whose cooperation results in a whole, different and more powerful than any individual, capable of feats like keeping the temperature in the colony stable, have long been studied with interest. They are an obvious example of a superorganism.
Now, Dr. Peters, in your new book, you talk about a superorganism, and you give the example of an ant colony. But I haven't been able to find an entry for superorganism in my dictionary of science.
Well, you see, many scientists have been skeptical about the usefulness of explaining large structures in nature that seem in some way to behave like an organism when they are not actually alive in any sense that we normally use the term. Appealing, simple ideas aren't always precise and can cause confusion.
So, what you're saying is that the superorganism idea of a group of organisms acting together like a larger organism has no precise definition.
Indeed. However, social insects such as ants, whose cooperation results in a whole, different and more powerful than any individual, capable of feats like keeping the temperature in the colony stable, have long been studied with interest. They are an obvious example of a superorganism.
Extract 3.
I tend to make it up as I go along. I don't map out stories beforehand. You have to know what road you're going along, but not what twists and turns it's going to have. But you've got to get to a destination, even though you don't know what it is. But all novels are different. I've written thrillers in which you kind of have to know the plot, which I find a bit tedious, actually, because then, in a way, you're just filling in the gaps with language. It's more stimulating if you take the reader on a route you don't know either. A magical mystery tour. And yet you have to trust you're unconscious enough to know you'll be able to tie up all the ends. And it's quite startling when you do, because you go through a patch when you're despondent. But you have to remember that this has happened before and hope it'll happen again. And I think I learned early on, you know, the pain of having to abandon something is so terrible that your unconscious will do anything to avoid it. Anything. Well, I tend to make it up as I go along. I don't map out stories beforehand. You have to know what road you're going along, but not what twists and turns it's going to have. But you've got to get to a destination, even though you don't know what it is. But all novels are different. I've written thrillers in which you kind of have to know the plot, which I find a bit tedious, actually, because then, in a way, you're just filling in the gaps with language. It's more stimulating if you take the reader on a route you don't know either. A magical mystery tour. And yet you have to trust you're unconscious enough to know you'll be able to tie up all the ends. And it's quite startling when you do, because you go through a patch when you're despondent. But you have to remember that this has happened before and hope it'll happen again. And I think I learned early on, you know, the pain of having to abandon something is so terrible that your unconscious will do anything to avoid it. Anything.
Extract 4.
Have you ever wondered why, in Western fashion, men's and women's coats and shirts do up on different sides? Is there a sensible reason for this, and when did this first begin? Well, buttons were first introduced into fashion in the 13th century for decorative effect, and started to become functional a couple of hundred years later. You don't start to see them in women's dress, however, until around the 19th century. The answer to the mystery seems to me to lie in the fact that upper-class women, who were at the forefront of fashion, were probably dressed by servants. Now, because these servants were likely to be right-handed and would be facing the lady they were dressing, the buttons would be on the opposite side to men's, who dressed themselves. It's a kind of mirror image, and the often-mooted suggestion of it having something to do with men needing to keep their sword arms free is irrelevant, because by the time women's buttons arrived,
men were no longer using swords. Have you ever wondered why, in Western fashion, men's and women's coats and shirts do up on different sides? Is there a sensible reason for this, and when did this first begin? Well, buttons were first introduced into fashion in the 13th century for decorative effect, and started to become functional a couple of hundred years later. You don't start to see them in women's dress, however, until around the 19th century. The answer to the mystery seems to me to lie in the fact that upper-class women, who were at the forefront of fashion, were probably dressed by servants. Now, because these servants were likely to be right-handed and would be facing the lady they were dressing, the buttons would be on the opposite side to men's, who dressed themselves. It's a kind of mirror image, and the often mooted suggestion of it having something to do with men needing to keep their sword arms free is irrelevant, because by the time women's buttons arrived, men were no longer using swords.
That's the end of part one.